When I was asked to come here and speak at this conference, I gave a variety of topics to the organizers from which to choose, and I was gladly surprised to discover that they were interested in having me speaking about the lessons of the Yom Kippur War. Not because this is my favorite war, but because I think studying the lessons of the Yom Kippur War, the events, the aftermath, and the way we Israelis, look at this war 40 years and some weeks later, reveals a lot of the hidden forces behind current Israel, behind what we have in Israel today. I'll begin by confessing that my presentation today is based on the work I did on many books on the topic of the Yom Kippur War. If you were listening carefully earlier to my bio, one of the three main things that I do is I'm the nonfiction editor for Israel's largest publishing house, Kinneret Zmor Advir. And I must tell you that from the viewpoint of a publisher, the Yom Kippur War is the war that keeps giving and giving. It never ends. Every year we publish new books about the Yom Kippur War, and almost every year we have those books reach the bestseller list. It is quite amazing to see. I can show you the books that I was responsible for in the last 4 or 5 years, and every year there were books about the Yom Kippur War. They usually come out just before Rosh Hashanah, and then they have for a couple of weeks the press and the public have something to discuss, and then we are starting to work on the book for next year. This year, because of the 40th anniversary of the war, or this last summer, I was responsible for the publication of 5 new books about the Yom Kippur War. One deals with the battle over Mount Hermon. One deals with the failure of the Air Force during the Yom Kippur War, deals specifically with the what happens in one unit of the Air Force during the war, a very famous unit of the Air Force. One deals with intelligence failure. One is a personal story of someone whose brother was killed, but first was missed in the war and then was apparently killed. And the fifth book I mentioned, the fifth book was written by a commander of one of the most important brigades that fought on the southern front. Later general, he was then colonel, but he later became General Amnon Reshef. It's a very thick book. We did it it's actually 6 books, because his book was published in 2 editions, a shorter version for the broader public, and a longer version that is really a professional version of the book for those who are truly interested in military affairs. So 6 books this year, and then I can count the other books that I published last year and the year before, etc. Some of these books put me in a very tough position as an editor, because when you're an editor of authors of books, you become friends with many of your authors. So I have 2 friends. One of them is Professor Uri Bar Yosef. He's an expert on intelligence affairs, and he wrote 2 very important books on the Yom Kippur War. One is called Hatzofe Shenirdam, the observer that fell asleep. and the other is called Hamalach, the angel. The angel is the story of Israel's most famous spy in Egypt, known as Ashraf Marwan, the advisor to President Sadat at the time. I'm not going to go into the detailed story of Ashraf Marwan. I'll just tell you that there is a huge debate in Israel up until today between two schools of thought. Those who believe, those among them, the then head of Mossad, Tzvi Zamir, who believe that Ashraf Marwan was a real spy and that he warned Israel at the last minute, thus enabling Israel to somehow prevent the Syrians from conquering all of northern Israel. The other school of thought, led by former intelligence, head of intelligence, General Zeira, who believe to this day that Ashraf Marwan was a double agent and that he misled the leadership of Israel on the way to war. And there is no way of reconciling these two schools of thought. Uri Bar Yosef, who wrote this book, Hamalach, was trying to prove Tzvi Zamir's version of events and to disprove the school of thought that believes Marwan was a double agent. Anyway, so he's one good friend that I have, Uri Bar Yosef. And I have another good friend. His name is Dr. Igal Kipnis. By the way, his book just came out in English about a month ago. His book is called 1973. And the book doesn't even deal with the war itself. The book ends when the war begins. Uri Bar Yosef wrote his books about intelligence failure, about Israel's intelligence failure that led to the war and to Egyptian and Syrian achievements during the war. Yigal Kipnis wrote a book essentially saying the intelligence doesn't matter, the military doesn't matter, it is all about failed diplomacy of Israel's leadership. Yigal Kipnis believes, and that's what his book is trying to prove, that Israel has had a peace deal on the table in the month leading to the war, that Anwar Sadat was very serious in his attempt to achieve peace with Israel, and that only because of Israel's resistance to peace, only because of Israel's decision not to pursue this channel for peace, only because of that Sadat decided to go to war against Israel. So you have two people, two authors, two experts. For me, they are two friends. And these two friends of mine have been fighting for the last year like cats and dogs, writing against one another, criticizing the work, each of them criticizing the work of the other. When they appear together in different places, they still refer to one another as my friend. But believe me, they are no longer friends. Both of them are friends of mine, but they can no longer be friends. And why do I tell you this story? I tell you this story because to this day, 40 years later, it is not even agreed among Israelis what exactly is the nature of the failure of 1973. For Uri Bar Yosef and many other writers, the book I published this year about the Air Force is essentially of the same school of thought. For many of them, the big issue of the war, the significant failure of the war was about intelligence. Why didn't Israel know in advance that the Egyptians and the Syrians are planning to go to war? And when we think about the this school of thought and the intelligence failure, you keep hearing the same theme, the same same sentences reappearing in every article, in every book. There was preconception. Israel's leaders and intelligence leaders were adamant in believing that the Egyptians will never dare go to war against Israel, because Israel is so strong, and Israel proved to them in the 1967 war that going to war against it makes no sense. So they were certain in their belief that the Egyptians will not start a war. The word hubris keeps coming back. They were too confident, overconfident in their ability to predict what the leaders of Egypt and Syria might or might not do. And the word lies or misleading information keeps appearing. The leaders of the intelligence community weren't always telling the truth. They weren't always doing what they were supposed to do. And they misled the political leadership to believe that they have the information when in fact they didn't have all the information that they needed to have. So this is the school of thought believing the Yom Kippur War was an intelligence failure. Hence, the lesson we have to take from that war is to enhance and better our intelligence. We need to know more. We need to be more careful in our assessment of the enemy's intentions. We need to be prepared for all kinds of surprises. All the lessons are about intelligence. Then there is a second school of thought, represented by another friend of mine, Dr. Amir Amezov. Amir Amezov wrote a book 2 years ago, and the name of the book is Tzlicha, Water Crossing. The book describes the last 60 hours of the war before Israel managed to cross the Suez Canal and into Egyptian territory. Possibly the most dramatic hours of the war, except for maybe the first or two first days of the war. The first 2 days of the war were probably the most traumatic for sure and very dramatic. But then, during the war itself, after the initial surprise, the most dramatic hours were the hours leading to the water crossing. These are the hours that separated Israel, that separated failure from success. These are the hours in which Israel was able to turn the tide and begin to go into Egyptian and Syrian territory. So for Amir Amezov and many of his peers that are military historians, the story is not about intelligence. The story is about military preparedness and command. The military was overconfident, like the intelligence. The military was overconfident. It was not well prepared to the war. It did not prepare itself to deal with certain new elements that the Arab armies introduced in this war, such as the the Russian ground air missiles, such as the anti-tank missiles, new tactical elements that the Arabs were able to introduce in this war were very problematic in the sense that the Israeli military was not prepared for them. The whole concept of how Israel intends to guard its southern border proved to be insufficient. The so-called Kav Barlev, the Barlev line of different, I lost the word, Mutzavim, outposts, of different outposts along the Suez Canal that was supposed to defend the southern border and could not withstand Egyptian attacks. So the problem and the issue of the war is the issue of military preparedness and later military command. The failure of the commanders that initially were responsible for the war, and the later successes of other commanders who came into the war to save Israel from its failure. The most notable of them, of course, is General Ariel Sharon, the military commander that crossed the canal eventually. So we have one school of thought thinking about intelligence and its lessons, and another one thinking about the military. So what are the lessons we draw from this second group of thinkers? Again, about preparedness, about Israel's ability to sustain itself in a longer war, and about the failure of the generals to get along with one another. Because one of the most troubling aspects of the war, and today we can even listen to the we can listen to the radio communication between the different generals. You could see all along the war that the generals are not just fighting a war against the enemy, they are also fighting a war against one another, each of them attempting to position himself better in the eye of history and to better position himself in order to later capitalize on it politically or publicly. So the general's war, Milchemet HaGeneralim, is a term that all Israelis are familiar with today. And the second group that focuses on military affairs is drawing mainly such lessons from the Yom Kippur War. The third group is the group that I initially presented, is the group that came to this game fairly late, led by historian Dr. Yigal Kipnis. And the most visible, the most impressive manifest of this group is Yigal Kipnis's book, 1973, and this book enrages the other two groups because it essentially says the military is of no such importance. The intelligence is of no such importance. There was a way to avoid the war. There was a way to achieve great achievement in having peace if only Israel's diplomats were not resistant to peace. And obviously, this school of thought that is now getting more and more ammunition by way of having more documents declassified from in different archives, both in the United States, some in Israel. Many protocols were released in recent weeks and months in Israel. So they are having more and more material on which to rely and with which to claim that President Sadat of Egypt was trying to get to an agreement with Israel. He approached then Secretary of State, or maybe he was then still the National Security Advisor, Henry Kissinger, attempting to convince him to get the Israelis on board. And Golda Meir, Prime Minister Golda Meir, and her ministers, Moshe Dayan, Yigal Alon, and others, were resistant to these attempts by the Egyptians to get an agreement. Now, this notion is not agreed to by all historians. It's not as if all Israeli historians believe that this is truly the case. Hence the war between these two friends of mine. Because Uri Bar Yosef think this is all nonsense. Sadat would not go to war only because Prime Minister Golda Meir told him to wait until after the Israeli elections. Golda Meir, when Kissinger approached Golda Meir saying there is a proposal on the table, she told him she does not want to deal with it until after the Israeli elections. Okay. Would Sadat go to such war only because he didn't want to delay the peace process in 2-3 months? To Professor Bar Yosef, this seems unreasonable. To Dr. Kipnis, this seems to be the case. Now, I'm not expert enough to tell you which of the two is right. What I can tell you is that 40 years after the war, we still aren't even in agreement in regards to the question, what was the real cause for this war? Was it Israeli resistance to peace? Was it an Arab attempt to punish Israel and force it into agreements that he didn't want? So we can't even agree on the parameters or on the core reasons for which this war was fought. So that's the first area in which there is disagreement between Israelis, but it's not the only area in which we can't agree on the Yom Kippur War. There are two other areas that I'd like to mention in that regard. One of them, and this is quite surprising, Israelis can agree on the simple question of whether Israel won or lost the Yom Kippur War. Okay? As I was preparing my remarks for today, I happened to I looked at different websites, and I happened to see a very interesting poll from the Pew Research Center that was published just a couple of days ago. And it deals with the question of whether Americans, 10 years after the Iraq War, think the U.S. won or lost the war in Iraq. Okay, do you have any idea what the numbers might look like? 46% of Americans believe that the U.S. had achieved its goals in Iraq. 43% of Americans believe that the U.S. did not achieve its goals in Iraq. So 10 years after the Iraq War, clearly Americans can't yet agree on the question of whether the U.S. won or lost, achieved or did not achieve its goal in the Iraq War. But we are 40 years after the Yom Kippur War, not 10 years. And yet again, we still cannot agree on the question of whether we won or lost the war. We all agree that the Yom Kippur War was a traumatic event, probably the most traumatic event in the short lives of the State of Israel. It was the only time in Israel's history, short of discussing the War of Independence, the only time after the War of Independence in which the Israeli leadership, not the public, the public was very scared before this 1967 war as well, but the only time in which the Israeli leadership was not sure, was not confident that Israel can withstand the attack and survive, was the Yom Kippur War. The only time in which, according to different publications, Israeli leaders considered the possibility of using one way or the other, or preparing to use what official documents call special means or special weapons, was the Yom Kippur War. The only time in which an Israeli leader considered the nuclear option. So, It was traumatic, on that we all agree. But did it end in failure, huge failure, or in huge success? The 40th anniversary of the Yom Kippur War was very interesting in that regard, because only this year, for the first time, I believe, there were more articles and opinion pieces and interviews in which Israelis argued that the war was actually won than articles claiming the opposite. For 39 years, most Israelis believed that Israel lost the war. The 40th anniversary was the time in which some people suddenly raised their heads, saying, well, you know, we didn't actually lose the war. It was a terrible war. It was a traumatic war. We almost lost the war, but it actually ended in great success. Israeli forces were very close to getting to Damascus in the north and to Cairo in the south. How can we say that the war was lost when it ended with Israeli forces deep into Egyptian and Syrian territory? So this is another area of disagreement, of deep divisions that Israelis still consider. The third and last area, and it's all, of course, interconnected. The third area in which Israelis don't truly agree regarding the war is about whether this war was the re-education of Israel or was it the re-education of the Arab world. Namely, was it a war from which Israel finally learned its lesson? We cannot always achieve our goals by force. We cannot always trust that our military will do the work for us. We have to try and compromise to get peace with our enemies. Was it us that learned the lesson from this war? Or maybe it was the other side. Maybe it was the Arab that finally came to realize that Israel cannot be destroyed. That no matter how successful a war can be launched against Israel, Israel will withstand the attack. That there is no way for the Arab countries to conquer Israel, to destroy Israel, to eliminate Israel. That the only way for the Arabs to live alongside Israel is to live alongside Israel peacefully. And that the only way for the Arabs to get some of their lands back is through peace and not through war. So was it the Israeli leadership that learned the lesson and hence had to compromise a couple of years later and give the Sinai Peninsula back to the Egyptians because we realized that we cannot hold to the Sinai Peninsula and perpetuate war? Or was it Sadat who ultimately learned his lesson, realized that he cannot get the Sinai Peninsula back by force, and that he has, in order to get it back for Egypt, he has to somehow accommodate Israel and sign a true peace agreement with Israel that includes open borders, an exchange of ambassadors, some type of commercial relations with Israel, not just a semi-peace that is really a ceasefire, but a real agreement that acknowledges Israel as a state that has the right to exist in this area. So, who's really the one that was taught a lesson in 1973 is the third area on which Israelis don't yet agree. And I'm not sure if they'll ever agree, but for sure, they don't yet agree. Let me just take a look at my watch because I have no sense of time. I'd like to describe some of the outcomes of this war that people tend to ignore as they look mostly at the dramatic events of the 19 days of war. The Yom Kippur War was the beginning of the end of a political era in Israel, the political era in which it was a country of essentially one-party rule. The Labor Party, called then Hamarach, doesn't matter, it changed names, Mapai, Hamarach, whatever you call it. The fathers of today's Labor Party were in power until and shortly after the Yom Kippur War. But the Yom Kippur War was a sign for Israelis that it is time for them to consider other options as well. That it's time for them to tell their leaders that they will not stay in power forever if they fail to achieve Israel's goals. So the Yom Kippur War was not just a military failure or a military landmark, it was also a political landmark. It's true that the Likud came into power only 4 years after the war, but it was really the war that made it possible for the Likud party to come into power and later become the majority, the ruling party for many years in Israel. The Labor Party never truly recovered from the trauma of the Yom Kippur War. It came back into power in 92 with Rabin as prime minister, and later in 99 with Ehud Barak as prime minister. But essentially, from 73-74 until today, the Likud party became the more important party in Israel's political life. That's one consequence of the Yom Kippur War. Second consequence of the Yom Kippur War, the erosion in the stature of military leaders and the military as a whole. If up until 1973 Israelis tended to trust their military leaders, from 1973 and on, the trust in military leaders was significantly eroded. Not that Israelis don't trust the generals. They do trust the generals even today much more than the politicians, and for obvious reasons. However, the sense that the generals are Israel's true leaders was destroyed in 1973, never to recover to go back to the stature that they had after the 1967 war and up until the Yom Kippur War. The Yom Kippur War also was also a landmark in being in presenting Israel with a moral crisis from which it did not recover until today. Up until the Yom Kippur War, Israelis were fairly convinced that Israel is the better side of the Israeli-Arab conflict, is on the right side of history, is morally superior to its enemies. From the Yom Kippur War and on, Israelis are no longer convinced to the same extent that Israel is always right. They are not. And if you look, it's amazing, when you look at the wars Israel had until Yom Kippur and after Yom Kippur, you can easily see it. There was an Israeli consensus when Israel fought its war of independence. There was a relative consensus when Israel fought the very short war of Kadesh in 56. There was a broad, very broad consensus after the 67 war. And of course, on the Yom Kippur war. But what happens later? Israel begins to fight wars that are highly controversial within Israel. In 1982, the first Lebanon war, the Israeli population is deeply divided as to whether the war is justified. Later comes the first Palestinian Intifada, not a war, but a conflict, a violent conflict. The first Palestinian Intifada, and again, Israelis are divided. The second Palestinian Intifada was better for Israelis in the sense of being unified. But then came the Second Lebanon War. And again, the Second Lebanon War is not as consensual among Israelis as previous wars. So from 1973 and on, Israelis find it much harder to agree on Israel's strategic goals, on Israel's policies, on Israel's justification in going to war or in launching military operations. It becomes harder and harder for Israeli politicians to sustain an Israeli consensus around a war or around military operations. The stature of the politicians has eroded, the stature of generals has eroded, and these are the people who are supposed to maintain the consensus. So obviously, the consensus is also eroding, and Israel find it much more difficult to fight a war against its enemies. And as Israel debates and keeps debating the causes for war, the result of war, the causes for the Yom Kippur War, and the result of, or the lessons of the Yom Kippur War, we keep coming back to the same question. And this is the question that my friend Dr. Kipnis raised in his book. You don't have to agree or disagree with his interpretation of the documents or with his interpretation of the diplomatic events leading to the war, but you have to give him credit for raising the right question. What is the right question about the Yom Kippur War? It's the question of whether Israel could achieve peace with Egypt before the war, whether it could have achieved a sustainable coexistence with its enemies before the war, or whether only because of the war and only after the war it became possible for Israel to have peace agreements with its enemies. First Egypt, of course, and later Jordan, and the much more controversial attempt to also achieve peace agreements with the Palestinian Authority, which is not a state. We also had, you might not remember, we signed peace agreement with Lebanon that was very short-lived and was signed under the threat of a gun. So it was not a true peace agreement. But from the Yom Kippur War and on, Israelis are looking for ways, looking more seriously for ways to compromise with their neighbors and see if there's any way of achieving peace without having to fight a war like we did before the Yom Kippur War. Questions? Okay, the question was whether we have any access to Egyptian documents from that era, whether we can trust them, and what do we learn from them about the war. The answer is complicated. We have Egyptian sources. Most of them are written testimonies and written memoirs of some of the leaders of the Egyptian of Egypt at the time, some of the military leaders and the political leaders of Egypt at the time. We don't always get from these documents clear answers on the questions that bother us. It is clear from these documents that the Egyptians were well prepared for the war. It's clear from these documents that President Sadat did not really mean to conquer all of Israel. He didn't expect to win the war in the sense that he will destroy Israel and wipe it off the map. His goals were fairly limited, and it was all meant for him to be able to achieve diplomatic success later. He didn't plan to have the Israeli army getting back at him and going into Egyptian territory. He was going to take some of the Sinai Peninsula up until a point, not even very deep into the peninsula, hold his ground, and then wait for the Americans and the Russians to break a ceasefire under which he will get all of the peninsula back. But then it will not be in return for real peace with Israel. It will be a reward for his achievement in war. Okay? He wanted to restore Egyptian pride. Restoring Egyptian pride was a major goal for Sadat because of the humiliation of the 1967 war. So he wanted to restore Egyptian pride and then to achieve his goals by way of limited military success followed by diplomatic success. Yes. Okay, I'm very glad that you asked this question because this will enable me to touch upon a whole component that I forgot all about. It's here in my notes and I need to mention this. When we think about the wars Israel had to fight after 1973, one of the most important trends that we see is that after 73, Israel was never again attacked by an Arab army. This was the last time for all Arabs, those who signed peace agreements with Israel and those who remained resistant to peace agreements with Israel, who remained adversarial to Israel, even they never again dared to send their military to attack Israel. Egypt signed peace agreement with us, and Syria did not sign a peace agreement, but the Syrian border was the most quiet border for the last 40 years. Almost no incidents were on the Syrian border since 73. The only incidents that we had are fairly recent because of the civil war that's going on in Syria. But up until the beginning of the civil war in Syria, the Syrian border was the quietest border Israel has with anyone. So neither Egypt, nor Syria, nor Jordan, nor Lebanon, no one dared attacking Israel violently since 1973, except for cases in which missiles, rockets were launched at Israel, not by a military, not by an army of a neighbor country, but mostly by different resistant groups. Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas in Gaza, all kinds of groups did launch attacks against Israel with rockets or suicide bombers, but no Arab army tried to attack Israel and invade Israel. There is one exception. Saddam Hussein, at the beginning of the 90s, did launch a couple of missiles, but this was really, he was attacked by the United States and the rest of the world, so this was just an attempt to divert the attention or to split the coalition. It was not a real attempt to attack Israel. So if you would like to support the notion that the true lesson of the war was learned not by Israel, but by the other side, you should look at the fact that never again was Israel attacked by an Arab army after 1973. It's a very important fact. And even when we look at the strategic situation of Israel today, we have to admit that there are a lot of important dangers that we have to deal with today, but the danger of being invaded by an Arab army is no longer there. We are no longer afraid of Arab invasion, which was the main Israeli concern up until and even after the Yom Kippur War, until we realized that it's never going to happen again. Well, Iran might do harm to Israel. It's not going to send its military and invade Israel. It's pretty far. Coming from Iran to Israel, you'd have to cross a couple of other countries on the way. Our concern with Iran is because of Iran's nuclear program, because it becomes a regional power. Because of its support to these groups that try to harm Israel. But again, even with Hezbollah is a power that bothers Israel, but it cannot invade Israel. There is no danger that Hezbollah tomorrow will send tanks and forces to conquer the northern Israel. So in this regard, we are safer today. Well, why then was the coalition broken? It was broken because Sadat was visionary enough and smart enough to understand that Israel is there to stay. He realized that winning by force, getting Sinai back by force, is not in the cards. And he wanted to restore Egyptian pride, get the Sinai Peninsula back, and he was willing to live with the facts that Israel is there to stay. For Assad, this was a more bitter pill to swallow. But him also, again, he didn't sign any agreement with Israel, but he never again tried to harass or invade Israel. Yes. Well, first of all, the nature of discussion in Arab countries is very different from the one we have in Israel. All Arab countries are not democratic countries. They don't have free and open debate on matters related to government policies. So expecting to see there the type of debate we're having in Israel, this is just not going to happen until they have better and improved governments. What we see in Egypt up until today is that the day of marking the Yom Kippur War is a day of celebration in Egypt. Every year the Egyptians have a military parade on October the 6th, marking their great victory on Israel in the 1973 war. Now, you can look at this with some sense of puzzlement, or you can mock them for celebrating a victory that was not a real victory, or you might say, well, they must feel that it was a victory for them after all, even though they lost so many soldiers, and even though it ended up with Israeli forces within Egypt, and even though it was not as clear a victory as most victories look like. The fact of the matter is that they celebrate. Israel doesn't celebrate the day of victory on October the 6th.
But they can't politically admit defeat. In other words, it's not feasible. Like you're
Well, the very short answer is, I guess, no. They can't be on the right side of history. The longer but still short answer is that events in the Middle East in the last 2 years demonstrate to us that this region is far from reaching its final stabilization and ultimate strategic and geographic arrangement. We are still, the Middle East is a region in transition, and what will come out of it is very, very hard to predict. Those who try to predict it, I think, are just nuts. The head of Israeli intelligence, a man I greatly respect, very smart man, appeared in a Knesset committee just a week before the fall of Mubarak in Egypt, predicting and telling Knesset members in an open discussion, we have the protocol, he was saying that the Mubarak regime is stable and is there to stay. A week later, Mubarak disappeared. So, you know, predicting now what's going to happen in Arab countries is just something that I don't think we should be doing. Yes, last question. Last question and then Mincha. Okay. Well, I'm not a psychologist, but from what I understand, there was a great sense of relief when the war ended. But later, when the soldiers came back and began share their stories and began digest the terrible experiences that they had during the war, a sense of gloom related to the war spread among the population, and this sense that was not a sense of victory but rather of relief from the end of the war gradually disappeared, and the Yom Kippur war remained in the Israeli memory as a failure. In some sense, similar to what Americans, the way American thinks about the Vietnam War. Israel is not a country of such. Israel cannot fight a war for three years. It's a small country. Our wars have to be short and decisive. Okay.